thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come to Heathrop. But I'm going to try and give you some idea of the problems facing the Syrian Orthodox Church and its diaspora in present time and in the immediate sort of background. If I'm not audible at the back, shove up a hand and I will and speak louder. Well, first of all, let me say a word or two about the Syrian Orthodox Church amongst the other Christian churches. Pope John Paul II gave a famous speech saying that the church breathed through two lungs. I audaciously suggested in an article that perhaps it actually had three lungs. The two lungs, of course, being the Greek East and the Latin West, and my third lung would be all the Oriental churches that got forgotten for various historical reasons. Now, if you study Syriac, which I do, you have the privilege of having sources from all three sides in a three-way split in Christianity, in Eastern Christianity, in the 5th and 6th century. And the Syrian Orthodox Church is one of the outcomes of this three-way split. The Greek East and the Latin West are, of course, Chalcedonian. They accepted the Council of Chalcedon in 451. But a lot of people didn't accept it. They found the doctrinal statement unsatisfactory, illogical, for various reasons, which I shan't go into. But the people who disliked it on one side were the Syrian Orthodox and today the Armenians, the Copts, and the Ethiopians and the Eritreans. So the so-called Oriental Orthodox churches. In the past, they've been called misleadingly Monophysite, which can be and often is interpreted as something quite different from what they hold. There's a wonderful comment on the entry in the first edition of the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, which had a wrong definition or misleading definition of who the Oriental Orthodox were. And this Indian bishop, as it happened, wrote some very sarcastic remarks about these learned Oxford dons. I'm glad to say it wasn't me who was responsible. I tried to restore a better definition in the later editions. Today, the official term to describe them from a Christological point of view is Miaphysite, as opposed to the Chalcedonian churches, which are Diophysite, two natures, one nature. But I shan't go into the complications of all this. The homelands of the Syrian Orthodox Church are basically the area we think of as North Mesopotamia. In modern parlance, that's Syria, eastern Turkey, southeastern Turkey, north Iraq, and a bit of western Iran. Now, since the 17th and 18th century, there's been a very important extension, and that is into India. Now, in India, Syrian or Syriac Christianity goes back right to, according to tradition, St. Thomas, which is possible but not provable. But until the arrival of the Portuguese in the 16th century, the church in India belonged or was subject to the Church of the East, whose patriarch lived in what is modern Iraq. But for various complicated reasons, there was a rebellion against the Portuguese domination and the Latinization of the rite, and the rebels, as it were, looked for support from Middle Eastern bishops, and it so happened that the bishop they got hold of belonged to the Syrian Orthodox Church. And so you have a remarkable phenomenon. In the course of the 18th century, mainly, the whole rite for these people changed from an East Syriac rite to a West Syriac rite. And that's quite a radical change. But I'm not going to talk about the situation in India. I shall keep strictly to the
Middle East and its diaspora westwards. The Syrian Orthodox Church is actually a very small church. If you want some sort of approximate numbers, those living in the Middle East plus those living in the diaspora are usually estimated between 400 and 500,000, so 500,000 at the most. In India, in fact, you have the largest body, at least 1 million. So, but in sort of international terms, these are minute figures. But the history is has a very important history. Now, if we turn to the modern history, the 20th century, 21st century, 20th century saw two traumatic events for the Syrian Orthodox. First of all, come the massacres of 1915. We usually think of only the massacres of the Armenians in the First World War in Turkey, but in fact a lot of other communities were equally affected, and the Syrian Orthodox was very seriously affected, as we'll see. I'll say something about figures in a minute. And then the other great traumatic event has been the emigration, leading to large diaspora communities, probably much bigger outside the Middle East today than in the Middle East. Now, in the early 20th century, this was mainly to North and South America, but in the latter half of the 20th century, it has been to Western Europe and Australia most recently. So those two traumatic events, massacres and emigration. So let me say a word or two about the massacres, or if you want to use the word genocide, many people do. In Syriac, the term used is sifo, or sword, the year of the sword. or sometimes it's the year of the firman, the official firman, and it does seem that the massacres were organized officially from at least a small group of young Turks in the central authorities. So this took place in the context of the rise of Armenian nationalism, which was in some ways the trigger for the overreaction on the part of the Ottoman Empire. But in the late years of the Ottoman Empire, there had been a number of local massacres. There was one very serious outbreak in 1895-6, which also involved the Syrian Orthodox. And there are some quite interesting accounts of this. But it was 1915 when Turkey, of course, had joined with Germany in World War I. And in June 1915, there seems to be an orchestrated series of attacks on the Syrian Orthodox and the Syriac populations, because there were also Chaldeans, Syrian Catholics involved in this awful series of massacres. Local Kurdish militias were set upon these villages, and huge numbers were either massacred or driven out and fled. And often they fled southwards into the Syrian desert, and many people died of starvation and heat, because this is midsummer. Now, it so happens that until quite recently, very little was known about the involvement of the Syrian Orthodox in these massacres and the other Syriac communities, simply because in Turkey it was not possible to publish this information. But in the diaspora, this is one of the good effects of a diaspora, it's been possible to publish accounts, and there have been two very important books bringing attention of English readers to these events. One, I put them both on the sheet, one by Sébastien de Courtois, originally in French, then now translated into English, and the other by David Gaunt, who works in Scandinavia and it's a very detailed and important collection of information using the Ottoman archives as well. One also has now a number of accounts put out by the Syrian Orthodox themselves. These are collections of memories or interviews of people who were children at the time. And there are a couple of books which I found very illuminating. One is by a man called Henno. It's now translated into German. It was written in Syriac. And this is an account, village by village. He went around collecting oral information with very precise numbers, as far as that's possible, for a large number of villages in an area known as Torabdin, the Mountain of the Servants, which is right down in southeast Turkey. if you know where Mardin is, it's just east of Mardin. The other book is more personal memoirs of someone who's a boy at the time, and these are his recollections. It's called Spilt Blood. It's a very moving account. Well, in the course of these massacres, which weren't just confined to June 1915, they went on, but June 1915 was the orchestrated beginnings. By the end of the First World War, the Syrian Orthodox Church in this area had lost over a third of its members, having been killed. And out of the 20 dioceses that were the Syrian Orthodox Church had at the beginning of the 20th century, 8 were completely wiped out. And whole areas were totally depopulated of any Christian presence. In Torabdin itself, people trickled back, and some villages managed to survive due to protection by local Muslim agas, but that only applied to a few. We actually have very interesting statistics available for this, provided by a bishop who was present at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, Bishop Barsam, who later became the Patriarch in 1932, I think it was 33. And he provided the Western authorities with figures, and these are probably pretty accurate. Roughly 90,000 people killed, and around about 350 villages in Torabdin and the surroundings were either destroyed entirely or anyhow badly damaged through, and the people scattered, the populace scattered. And it's broken down into local areas. And if one looks at documentation that we have for population of Syrian Orthodox in this area in the 20s and 30s, you can see which areas were totally totally left without any Syrian Orthodox or indeed Christian presence at all. Now, at the Paris Peace Conference, Bishop Barsam put in a plea to the European authorities, urging very strongly that some sort of guaranteed protection would be given to the Christian minorities in any settlement. But as he complains in a later sort of diary, long after the event, he was simply ignored. What eventually happened was a few years later in the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. This was after the Greek invasion of Istanbul, of Western Turkey, and their routing, their defeat. So the Turkish authorities were feeling very much on top of things. And although in the Treaty of Lausanne some protection was given, some recognition at least was given to minorities, but they were unspecified. And just under a decade later, in 1932, the definition of who the minorities were was actually specified very particularly, and it was limited to the Armenians, the Greeks, and the Jews. So from that point on, the Syrian Orthodox had absolutely no recognition as a minority at all. And this is still the case today. It has caused immense, and still causes immense problems for them in Turkey. Now, in 1925, their patriarch, Elias, who formerly had his residence in Mardin, he was actually expelled. It's unclear quite whether he was officially expelled or whether he just took flight. Anyhow, he needed to, had to leave Turkey. In fact, he ended up in India, where he died in 1932, and you can visit his grave. It's almost a pilgrimage site in India today. So the patriarchate, which had been in Mardin, removed and was officially removed under Patriarch Barsaum when he became patriarch in 1933, and it moved to Syria, to Homs, and then 1959 it moved to Damascus, where it is today. Now, the 1930s saw a very strong movement of Turkification of the Republic of Turkey. And this took all sorts of different forms, but two very noticeable and important forms are, in 1934, people were obliged to take Turkish names, and so that's why you'll find that people from Turkey who are Syrian Orthodox, they will have Turkish first names and second names. And this, I think, is still probably the state policy, certainly for surnames. I have once had a student who was whose family had emigrated from Turkey, and the moment he had a chance, or they had a chance, they changed the name to their old Syriac name. In fact, I know several people who did that. The other thing in this process of Turkification was in the 1940s, there was a movement to rename all the villages. Now, the villages in southeast Turkey, where these people lived, all had ancient Aramaic names, which sometimes went back as far as the 6th or 7th century BC. Now, these were all removed, and so a blanket of oblivion was placed over them. And nowadays, this still applies. You can't use officially any of the old names, but people, of course, remember what they are. And if you've got a responsible book about Turabdin, you will find a sort of list of equivalents. So the Syrian Orthodox, as it were, have their, as it were, cultural inheritance wiped out in this form of all their local names and their personal names. And then they are subject to the effects of international relations between Turkey and elsewhere, and especially between Turkey and Greece. And at special times in the mid-1950s, when there were riots in Turkey, in Istanbul, and large, the Greek quarter was sacked, this was also a period of great tension for those in Syrian Orthodox in southeast Turkey as well. And likewise, in the Turkish invasion of North Cyprus in 1974, again, this was a case where the Christian population in Turabdin had all sorts of difficulties imposed upon them, since they were seen as part of the enemy. And added to that, southeast Turkey has been economically depressed, and you have the local, it's very backward, or was very backward 20 or 30 years ago, and a lot of local oppression from the Kurdish Arkas, who are the great landowners. And on my first visits to Turabdin, I was able to, well, not able, I was witness to some of the problems that they were having. And in the short time I was there, I think it was only a week or 10 days, several girls, marriageable girls, had been abducted to be married off to Kurdish Muslims. And this has been a constant problem, and it's not one that's come to an end. And then in 1990s, late 1980s, especially in 1990s, you have the Kurdish insurgents, the PKK in eastern Turkey, and the Syrian Orthodox are caught between the Turkish army and the PKK. Each side thinks they're the Syrian Orthodox on the enemy's side. And so they suffer very greatly as a result. And added to that, especially in the 1990s, you have targeted assassinations of all the leading figures in order to encourage the depopulation of the Syrian Orthodox. And as we'll see, this is well into the period of the large-scale emigration. Well, I've said a certain amount specifically about Turkey, partly because that's quite well documented, thanks largely to information provided by the late Archbishop Julius Čiček, who was the first bishop in Holland of the diaspora. He was a very meticulous man, and he periodically provided figures of family numbers in different villages, and these were published in his magazine in Western Europe. So one can build up a very interesting picture from that. Now, in other Middle Eastern countries, of course, you have the various mandates and then eventually independence. After Saifo, the massacres, or during them, large numbers of people who managed to escaped to Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and North Iraq. Now, in Iraq, on independence in 1932, the Syrian Orthodox weren't, in fact, affected. It was the Church of the East who suffered from massacres at that point. So it was later on that two events, really, in the middle of the 20th century caused renewed trouble. First of all, you have the pan-Arabism promoted by Nasser and the Union of Syria and Egypt, and many Syrian Orthodox who fled and settled in Syria moved at that point to Lebanon. And then in 1948, you had the creation of the State of Israel, and that caused a new wave of emigration. Now, in the secular regimes of Syria and Iraq, these were at times quite beneficial to Christians. As long as you've got a strong hand minorities usually feel much safer. And in fact, there were certain benefits in Iraq in 1972. Syriac was recognized actually as a cultural language, which meant you could publish in Syriac and you could broadcast in Syriac in areas where there was a large Syriac, that's modern language, the Surah, was present. And in 1975, a few years later, there was actually a Syriac section of the Iraqi Academy founded. And for many years, that produced very good work. And in Syria, too, there were things that were much better for Christians in that country than for any other country. There was the ability to build churches, and a huge number of churches were built as a result, and for the Syrian Orthodox, the two main building projects were, first of all, the seminary, a very large seminary of St. Ephrem at a place called Ma'aret Zidnaya, north of Damascus, about half an hour's drive. This was consecrated in 1996, and then a new monastery built out in the desert, really, in eastern Syria, at a place called Tel Wahdiyat, beautifully built in sort of traditional Turabdin style, and this was consecrated in 2000. But these are just the most, as it were, noticeable of these building events. But of course, more recently in Iraq, we've had all the Syriac communities suffered from the campaigns against the Kurds under Saddam Hussein, and the forced relocation of Christian villages in the north to Baghdad, whence they only had to flee again after the American invasion. There are quite a number of Syrian Orthodox villages in the north, and also Syrian Catholic villages, besides the Chaldean, who were, of course, the majority. And all this has led to huge-scale emigration, as is well known. And this emigration is both internal in the Middle East to Jordan and Syria, received huge numbers of refugees, and thence and also to Europe and America. And of course, the situation in Syria today, everyone in the Christian communities there is extremely worried that the sort of chaos of Iraq might arrive in Syria if things go wrong. Now, let me turn more directly to the emigration. As I said at the beginning, the first half of the 20th century is primarily to North and South America, and the second half is primarily to Western Europe, apart from the internal immigration in the Middle East. And after the massacres of 1895-6, quite a large number of people, especially from the towns in southeast Turkey, went to North America, and also to South America, to Brazil and Argentina. And those in North America tended to settle, each town, the people would settle in one particular place. Those from Diyarbakir went to New Jersey, those from Harput went to Massachusetts, Worcester, and those from Mardin went to Canada. So that sets the pattern of the settlements in North America and also South America. After 1915, a huge internal emigration from Turabdin southwards. Those who could escape to America settled largely in Rhode Island, and part of that community later moved to Los Angeles. And it was only in 1927-28 that there were actually Syrian Orthodox churches first consecrated in North America, one in New York, which no longer exists, the other in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is still there. Another important sort of wave of emigration took place in 1924 from Urfa, that's ancient Edessa in South Turkey. Edessa is the, as it were, the birthplace of Syriac Christianity, or is regarded as, because it was there that Abgar is, according to tradition, had his correspondence with Christ, inviting Christ to come and escape to a nice retirement in Edessa, which of course wasn't taken up. but the correspondence actually is creation of the 4th century, probably, or 3rd century. But anyhow, although there were large-scale massacres in Urfa, both the Armenian and the Syriac communities, those who remained or who went back, escaped and went back and settled back in Urfa, in 1924 they decided that things were not going well for them, so they emigrated en masse to Aleppo. And if you go to Aleppo today, there's actually a whole quarter in North Aleppo where the people are, from Aleppo, the families ultimately from Aleppo, live. They have their own church and they're very proud of it, and they keep rather separate from the rest of the community. And then a few years later in Turkey, you have the Kurdish revolt of 1925-26, and this again drove many people out, Syrian Orthodox, out from those who remained in Tor Abdin. And it was after this that the town, modern town of Kamishli in eastern Syria was founded. And Kamishli has become a focal centre for Syriac culture in subsequent years. There's an annual festival of the Syriac language there, held each year now. Then, after the foundation of Israel, a lot of the Palestinian families living in Jerusalem either settled in Bethlehem, though far more were emigrated, if they could, to North America. And amongst those who emigrated was the bishop who became the first bishop of the Syrian Orthodox in America, Metropolitan Athanasius Samuel. I got to know him quite well, and he did a great deal for organizing the diaspora in America. He died in 1995. So after the foundation of Israel, that was the first sort of mid-century influx to America. Later on in the 1960s and especially 1990s onwards from Iraq, a large numbers again emigrated to America. Then in the second half of the century, in the early 1960s, the German government and the Turkish government signed an agreement for immigrant workers from Turkey because there was a labour shortage in Germany. And of course, the vast majority of these immigrant workers were Muslim, but quite a number of people, young men from Tor Abdin, joined the these workers, and this went on for about 10 years that Germany needed or welcomed these migrant workers. And eventually, when Germany decided it no longer wanted them, the families of these workers decided they wanted to join their sons. And it was in the 1970s to 1980s that large numbers of families migrated from Tor Abdin, southeast Turkey, to Germany, and also to Sweden and to the Netherlands. And this only increased with the Kurdish troubles in southeast Turkey in the 1980s and especially in the 1990s. And at this stage, people started coming to Western Europe as asylum seekers. And in many cases, they got political asylum. And then eventually both Turkey and Sweden, which had in the meantime welcomed huge numbers of very large numbers of people from southeast Turkey, they decided to put a brake on the immigration, and now it's actually very difficult to get in. Well, this process of emigration from Tor Abdin meant that Tor Abdin itself was largely emptied of Christians. The figures, you can see the gradual emptying of the individual villages through the figures that Bishop Čiček has provided in his diocesan magazine. And I tried to put these together in the volume called The Hidden Pearl in a tabular form to illustrate this. Now, what was left in Tor Abdin, only about 2,000 people, was, besides those 2,000 people, two very important monasteries. One was Deir ez-Zafran, the former patriarchal monastery, whose building is very dramatic. It goes back to the probably 6th century. And it's just outside Mardin. And the other, which is in some ways the more important, at least in the vision of the community, is the monastery of Mar Gabriel, which is quite a long way further east of Mardin, a long way from anywhere apart from local villages. And the monastery of Mar Gabriel has got into the news a lot recently because there's a current court case, partly by local villagers, hostile villagers who are trying to seize some of its lands. That seems to have been thrown out. But more important, it's the Turkish, I think it's the Forestry Commission, has a case against the monastery trying to seize some of its land. And this case was in fact thrown out locally, but then the Forestry Commission appealed to Ankara, and rather to everyone's surprise, the appeal, it was found against the monastery. And so that's the present situation. And as we'll see, this has caused a great deal of angst amongst the diaspora community, and I'll come back to that later. Now, in recent years, because of the better economic condition in southeast Turkey, a number of people, small numbers of people, have actually returned. And one or two villages have been repopulated with, of course, they come back with a lot of money, so they're able to build houses on a much grander scale than their grandparents ever lived in. And very recently, one of the monasteries in this area has actually been repopulated, the monastery of Mar Augun, which sort of overlooks Turabdin is a mountainous area, and it slopes down to the Mesopotamian plain and overlooks Syria. And Mar Augun is wonderfully situated on the slope overlooking the Mesopotamian plain. And there's a monk from, I think, ultimately from Turabdin, who I met when he was studying in Damascus. But he's decided to try and resettle Mar Augun Monastery, and apparently he's now there. Now, I've concentrated again largely on Turkey, since that is much the best documented, but of course, large-scale emigration, especially to Sweden from Iraq. In the late 70s onwards, we have the beginnings of emigration to the southern hemisphere, to Australia. This started in the late 70s and has continued till today. It so happens that London, or Britain, has had a very small population of Syrian Orthodox migrants. And these mainly come from Iraq, and not all that recently. Unfortunately, our government does not pay much attention to refugees from the situation currently in Iraq. Now, let me turn now, sorry, I've taken rather longer over that than I had expected. Let me turn to the challenges that meet the diaspora. The main locations are in Germany, there are about 50,000, Sweden about 50,000, Holland 12,000 perhaps, and then rather smaller communities in Belgium, France, Switzerland, Austria, and very small in this country. Now, the first priest to come to Europe was a man who I had first met as a schoolmaster in Turabdin. He arrived in 1971 and is still alive. But the real organization of church life began thanks to the former abbot of Mar Gabriel Monastery, who became first patriarchal vicar and then archbishop, Mar Julius Čiček, who settled in Holland. And he was a man of great vision. He was the first, let me see, in 1977, give you a date, the patriarch set up two new dioceses, completely new dioceses in Europe, one in Sweden and one called Middle Europe, which was that of Mar Julius Čiček. And he settled, as I say, in Holland. And a few years after he'd come to Holland, he was able to buy up an old school, and he converted this into a monastery, which was consecrated in 1984, Monastery of St. Ephrem. I was actually at the consecration. It was a wonderful occasion. Now, monasteries in the Syrian Orthodox tradition are very important focal points for the community. And it was really a brilliant thing to do from the point of view of the diaspora, for it provided the people all over Holland, and indeed in Germany, because it's on the German border, with, as were, a focal point where they could come together, and indeed on feast days, huge numbers did congregate at, and they still do, at this monastery. Now, a few years later, in 1996, he was able to buy a former Dominican convent in Warburg in Germany, and this is now the monastery of St. Jacob of Sarug, great poet of the 5th, 6th century. And then yet another monastery he was able to buy up, this I think was an old Franciscan monastery, in Switzerland in 1999, and this is renamed as the Monastery of Mar Augen. So the Syrian Orthodox in Europe now had these three monasteries, which, as I say, serve as focal points for the community. Nothing like that actually happened in Sweden, although Sweden likewise had its own diocese from 1977, but for reasons that will become clear, there were problems in Sweden, today there are now two archbishops in Sweden because of the question of identity. And let me turn to this highly controversial point. Now, in the Middle East, of course, people have a religious identity, whereas in the West, it's a case of national citizenship. Now, from the point of perspective of the immigrants from the Middle East, the Syrian Orthodox and other Christian immigrants, Europe is a Christian area, or a Christian series of Christian countries. And so when they came, they thought it best to emphasize themselves as Christian and not as Muslim. And this was all the more necessary, as most Europeans tended to see all the Middle East as Muslim. And then there's an added problem for Syrian Orthodox immigrants, because they are, in the host countries, categorized by the state of the country of origin. And so this added great problems with the designation Syrian Orthodox, if you didn't come from Syria. In fact, the term Syrian Orthodox was long in use, well before the state of Syria, but unfortunately the state of Syria is better known. So you can see that there was a great need to identify themselves to Europeans. They didn't. If you're a refugee from Turkey, you didn't want to be called a Turk, and if you were a refugee from somewhere else, or just a migrant from some other country, you might not be too pleased to be called a migrant from that country. So there's the need to identify yourselves to Europeans. This is not a problem in Syriac itself, because there's one term, Suryoyo, Suryoye in the plural, which is traditionally translated by Syrian, and the English translation and likewise other Western translations that's the cause of the problem. Now, in the United States in 2000, when there was a census, the various Syriac bodies, Syriac churches, got together, or at least certain people got together, and persuaded the census authorities not to have them categorized as Arabs or Middle Eastern, I forget exactly what the category was, but as either Assyrians, Chaldeans, or Syriac. And Syriac with a C rather than Syrian. And this is the first time that Syriac has been used as a national identity as opposed to a language identity. This, in fact, caused a great deal of rumpus amongst the various communities because Syrians said, we don't want to be called Chaldean too, and so on. But, in fact, you were given that sort of block possibility on the census. Now, the term Assyrian had for a long time been adopted by people from, many people from the Church of the East. And the official title of one of the two patriarchs of the Church of the East is the Assyrian Church of the East. This goes back to the archaeological discoveries of ancient Assyria in the 19th century. And some archaeologists thought that maybe, speculating, that the local Christian population in North Iraq were descendants of the ancient Assyrians. Well, this caught on amongst the local population, both primarily amongst the Church of the East, where it quickly became very popular, but also amongst some Syrian Orthodox. And in the early 20th century, it was taken up by certain Syrian Orthodox intellectuals in southeast Turkey. And the most famous of them was a man called Naum Fayek, who is regarded as the great hero of those who adopt the Assyrian title. Now, this issue of what to call yourself became a very serious one in Sweden, where the first Christian immigrants in the, I think it's the early 60s, actually came from Lebanon, and they were from the Church of the East, and they called themselves Assyrian. So, not surprisingly, Swedish state thought that all Christians from the Middle East were Assyrians. And so the term was taken over. But of course, when the Syrian Orthodox started coming in large quantities to Sweden, this was really in the 70s, in the middle 70s, there developed a really bitter debate about whether to call yourself Assyrians or Syrians, in the Swedish terms. And this led to the creation, eventually in 1996, of a separate patriarchal vicariate. So you have one bishop for the Assyrians, Syrian Orthodox, and the other for the Syrian Orthodox. And so if you go to Sweden today, you'll find in most towns where Syrian Orthodox are settled, you've got two churches, one for one group, the other for the other. And there are also two football teams, quite famous ones within Sweden. And if they are playing each other, there's great trouble. And there's been serious riots. There are now also two TV channels, one for each. So you can see that it's a highly divisive matter. Now, what position has the church taken over this? In the early 20th century debate about the name, a number of famous church figures, including Patriarch Barsaum, then a bishop, and another famous bishop, Bishop Dalabani, they tended to use Assyrian, Aramean, Mesopotamian, all as possible names. And this actually is quite reasonable, because if you think back to the Assyrian Empire of the 7th century BC, it was in fact largely by that time Aramaic-speaking. But later on, the church took a much stronger line against Assyrian. And this is probably in reaction to the Church of the East, which was adopting the term Assyrian as its official name. And in 1952, Petroch Barsan had issued a decree on what he called the correct name, Syrian and not Assyrian. And this has been upheld by subsequent patriarchs, Jakub III and the present patriarch, Zakra I. Now, this problem with the name is really a question of how you identify yourself. It's a question of ethnicity and not of language. But language does get involved. And language in the diaspora is a great problem. Now, in the West, with this new freedom to publish, the question arises, what language you publish in? Now, it's no problem if it's in the language of the host country, the Swedish, English, whatever it may be, but there are many problems if it's in the language of the country of origin, because the diaspora communities come from different Middle Eastern countries, and in particular, do you choose Turkish or Arabic? Or if you're going in for a traditional language, do you use classical Syriac or modern Syriac? And classical Syriac is actually spoken by a number of priests and a few educated lay people. And if you're talking about modern Syriac, are you talking about Toroyo, the language of Torabdin, or the local dialect of North Iraq, Sorin? And again, if you choose modern Syriac, whether Toroy or Soreth, you have to choose what script are you going to write. Now, neither of these dialects, and especially Toroyu, has much of a tradition of writing down in, it's a purely oral language. So there's no tradition of writing it in Syriac characters, or very little. And so what you'll find, if you look at any of the huge number of cultural magazines put out in Western Europe in the last few decades, a huge number of different choices. And often a magazine will actually be trilingual or quadrilingual. And some of the most famous widely read ones, the two widely read ones, one for the Syrians, one for the Syrians, Syriacs, I should say, each of these uses a whole number of different languages. In Sweden, it's also a matter for the state, because the state agreed that in areas where there are large Syriac populations, they should teach the modern dialect of Torabdin. And so they needed it written down. So they commissioned a professional linguist who happened to be a Chaldean, Dr. Yusuf Ishaq, to devise a standard form of transcription of Toroyu into Latin script. And he did it, and it's really very successful, though not everyone accepts it. There are now a number of novels written in Toroyu in Latin script, and also a large number of children's books. So there are all sorts of practical questions. And likewise, what do you call the language that you're teaching? And this has, especially in Sweden, has been a great problem. And the Swedish government commissioned a Swedish academic, to come up with some solution on it. And it's very recently a problem in quite a different part of the world, actually in Turkey, where in Mardin there is a new state university being set up, and amongst the languages being taught is Syriac. This isn't clear whether it's meant classical Syriac, I think it probably is intended, or whether it's modern Syriac, Toroyu. but there is a conflict going on between those who want it to be called Assyrian, which is totally unsuitable from an academic point of view, and those who want it to be called Syriac. At the moment, if you look at the website, it's called Assyrian, which is very unsatisfactory. So these are just some of the very practical problems that people have. Now, if you don't have to write things down, things become much simpler. And one of the other things that you'll find has been happening in very large quantities is people have been putting out cassettes and then CDs of music using both Toroyo Soreth, classical Syriac, of course, those from Syria will use Arabic too. I don't think there's any, at least I've not come across any actually in Turkish. But on the bibliography I've given you, there's a very interesting book called The Syriac Discography, which lists huge numbers of these things with very interesting little comments. So I see I'm already overrunning the time.
You've got 2 or 6.
Well, I won't say too much more. Let me say something about the benefits of the diaspora. One, of course, is in the use of technology. And if you use a computer and you need foreign scripts, there is now the possibility of using Syriac in Unicode. And that's a huge advantage for someone like myself, because in the past either I had to use a typewriter, I had a Syriac typewriter, or write it by hand, or get someone else to write it, because it was far too expensive to have set in print. Of course, the internet has brought huge advantages for communication, and there are at least 40 different websites for the different Syriac cultural communities, let alone the church communities, scattered over mainly Western Europe. So this is a completely new form of communication, and it's been taken up on a large scale. The other benefit is in the area of ecumenism, because it's very significant that dialogue with these non-Chalcedonian churches has really only started in the second half of the 20th century, precisely the time when people from these communities come in large numbers to the West, and so for the first time the Western churches become vaguely aware that there is another, this third lung of Christianity existing. So it's a two-way benefit. It's a benefit for the Western churches, who learn that there is another completely different Oriental Christian tradition provided by the Syrian Orthodox and, of course, the other Syriac churches, which has its own contribution to the Christian tradition as a whole. But for the Syrian Orthodox and the other Christian Syriac Christian churches, they are no longer seen as something you write out of history. They're no longer utterly marginalized, but they've become a presence in Europe, even though not yet do they really feature in standard books of church history, except very exceptionally. But that will take a bit of time to change, but it certainly will need to change. Now, with the arrival of these large numbers of immigrants from the Syriac churches, and especially the Syrian Orthodox Church in Germany and Sweden, they've actually been very well welcomed by local dioceses and local churches, both the Catholic and the Lutheran Church. And often they've been provided with church premises and assisted in all sorts of ways. So this was a very good way of each side learning more about the other. And on a purely ecumenical level of ecumenism, the couple of highlights concerned with the Syrian Orthodox Church. And these, first of all, was the first ever meeting of a Syrian Orthodox Patriarch with the Pope of Rome. That was in 1971 with Patriarch Ignatius Jakob with Paul VI. And then, more important in practical terms, was a meeting in 1984, again in Rome, this time Pope John Paul II and Patriarch Ignatius Zacca. And with that, there was a common Christological statement. So an event of great significance, because this was, as it were, bridging the gap between the Chalcedonians and the non-Chalcedonians that had opened up after the Council of Chalcedon. And this common statement also had a lot of practical consequences in that there was limited intercommunion if someone on one side was in had no church of their own to go to, they could receive communion in the other church. That, of course, applied mainly to the Syrian Orthodox receiving communion in Western churches. Perhaps I should end at this point, except I do want to mention one other thing. I mentioned that the monastery of Mount Gabriel in southeast Turkey has become a real focal point of almost the Syrian Orthodox identity of their home, in their homeland. Of course, this mainly applies to people from Torabdin, but many people from outside, from Syria, Iraq, whose families sometimes originated from Torabdin, but who left after the massacres, fled after the massacres. This problem that Mount Gabriel Monastery has with the Turkish state, started in 2008, has actually had quite a unifying effect amongst the diaspora, including amongst the Assyrians and Syriacs. In January 2009, in mid-January, a very cold month, of course, in Berlin, there was a huge demonstration. 19,000 people, almost entirely from the Syriac diaspora, gathered in solidarity with Mount Gabriel Monastery. Well, this case, as I say, hasn't been resolved, and one only hopes that it will eventually get resolved. But at the moment, it seems to have got stuck in the at a very difficult point. But at least with that unifying effect, something bad has a good consequence. And so all these things, the immigration and even though the diaspora has a huge number of problems today, there are these good outcomes as well. And one hopes that these good outcomes override in the long term all the disadvantages. So I think I'll stop with that.
Okay, thank you very much, Sebastian.